Right, now you may remember that a couple of months ago I told you briefly about a conference I attended in London called the Justice Conference. And the plan was that I was going to give this sermon early December, but then I lost my voice, so we had to postpone that. So today I'd like to tell you a bit more about it. The conference was organized by Tearfund, which is sort of the development work arm of the Evangelical Alliance. Tearfund started 50 years ago. They actually had their jubilee year last year. And they now work in about 50 countries all over the world. And they support local churches to put justice into practice in many different ways. For instance, via education, improving access to clean water, improving agriculture, giving information about hygiene. And they mainly work through local churches. They hardly send anyone out from the West nowadays. And they also support churches to give awareness training to their church members and others in local communities, for instance, about the role of women from a biblical perspective, forgiveness, helping people to start small businesses. But anyway, they organized this conference, and it was the first time it was held in the UK. It took part, or it started in the US a couple of years ago, initiated by a man called Ken Bitsma. And since then it has spread, has taken place in various countries like Canada, Hong Kong, Australia, and the Netherlands. And of course my ears perked up when I heard that. And I was told at the conference that a week earlier the same conference had been held in the Netherlands for the third time there, and it attracted there as many as 1,800 people. Well, the London conference attracted about 500 to 600 people. And I was actually quite impressed by the variety. There were white people, black people, Asian people, teenagers, people probably as old as in their 80s, and ethnic free. And the variety of Christian organizations were represented at the conference. They had stalls with information, but they also provided speakers. And in two days, and I didn't even stay till the end, I heard about 15 talks about all sorts of topics. And they all had one thing in common, that they were related to justice and how we Christians can do justice, what the Bible teaches about justice. The theme was all things new, and there were four subcategories, as it were. Our relationship with God, our relationship with ourselves, with others, and creation. And the topics of the talks varied from hidden racism in the church, to doing justice to deaf people in Uganda, from fostering to getting involved in politics or influencing politics and decision making. I attended the conference very much with our church in the back of my mind, thinking, what can I take away from here that might help our church, that will help us do justice? Because we've been thinking about that for a few years now. And I don't think I'm going to be repetitive, as I would like us to focus on some aspects that so far we haven't covered yet. Now, doing justice still, you know, can sound like something abstract, big, too complex, too overwhelming. Yes, we can pray, we can give money, we can treat the people around us well, but what else can we do as individual Christians, as a church? A while ago I heard an interview with Bishop Michael Curry. I don't know if you remember the name. He was the man who preached at the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle last May, I believe. At the end of the interview he said something like, we don't have to change the whole world, we can't, but we can do our own bit. In our own daily lives, by loving the people around us. If you ever get overwhelmed by all the needs in the world, think of that. And I think with that in the back of our minds, we can all be involved in doing justice. Now, two topics stood out for me during and after the conference, and they're actually completely separate from each other, apart from the fact that there is this link to justice. But I'd like to take the opportunity to talk about both of them. Now, the first one is related to care for the creation, And it took me a while to figure out why did they include that in a justice conference. And then I thought it was probably about doing justice to creation through our lifestyles. And that brings me to the first reading for today from Genesis 1. And I'm using information given to me at the conference, so it's not all, you know, just me thinking this. The speaker was a lady called Ruth Valerio. And she pointed out that the command to care for creation, as Margaret has just read, was given before the fall, before we humans turned our backs on God. And I'd like to suggest that that implies that we all have a responsibility to care for creation, to live here responsibly. That command, that responsibility has never been taken away, even when Christ came. Now, I know there are Christians in certain parts of the world, when they see and hear about all the wars and tensions and disasters in the world, they will say, well, it's all been predicted by Jesus, hasn't it? So we know that things will get worse before he comes back. Or they say, well, everything will be well when he returns, so why bother? We will get a heaven and a new heaven and a new earth. And the implication seems to be that indeed we don't have to bother, and all we need to do is preach the gospel. But again, God wanted mankind to look after creation even before the fall. And that command, as I just said, is as valid today as it was then. Now let me remind you of another passage in the Bible, John 3:16. I think we all know that verse. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. Now did you know that the Greek word that is used there for world is actually the word cosmos? Now cosmos is a lot bigger than just this planet Earth. It's a lot bigger than just as human beings. It is the entire universe. So God loved the entire universe so much that he sent Jesus. He wants to, in the end, he wants to redeem all of creation, not just us. So therefore I'd like to suggest that that verse too encourages us to look after creation and basically tells us that we have a responsibility in that area. And that's where I think our lifestyles come in. Now let me start off by saying that I'm very aware that each of us live in very different circumstances, practically, financially, health-wise, and therefore our opportunities are different. But I think all of us can do something to look after creation. And I'd like us to focus a bit for the next few minutes on climate change, which was one of the things that was covered in the conference. Now experts say that if we don't do anything, climate change will start to seriously affect this planet in 12 years' time. That's pretty soon. And if you think about it, that's quite frightening. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of activity causing climate change comes from big industry. They cause a lot of pollution. And compared to that, our individual lifestyle may just feel like a drop in the ocean. But going back to what we have already read, what I've already said about, you know, what you've read in Genesis 1, John 3:16, I'd like to suggest that we can't ignore the issue. So what can we do? Just to give you a few examples, just a few ideas. How often do you use your car when you don't really need to? Years ago, someone told me that he used his car to go to a shop just a few hundred yards away. Not because he couldn't walk, but because he was too lazy to walk. That's what he told me. And he clearly didn't live in Newtown where I lived, because once I moved my car, within minutes my parking space was gone, so I wouldn't agree with taking my car only for a few hundred yards. And also, I have to tell you this, this morning, because I knew that Corey was going to pick up Vera and Iris, so I thought, I can cycle. Lovely. If it isn't raining, I will cycle. So I get out, get myself ready, and I can't unlock the padlock on my back gate, and it's frozen. And I didn't have time to sort all that out. So here I am. I've taken the car. But there you go. But apparently the pollution caused by our use of cars is a major contributor to climate change. So we may want to reconsider how often we use our cars. Other examples, how much water do we use? How long do we take a shower? Do we let the tap run? Why don't we brush our teeth, wash our hands, wash a cup? I mean, at work, you know, people open the tap really wide just to wash one cup, and then it runs for about 2 minutes, and I'm thinking, oh, all that water. Apparently it also helps to reduce our meat consumption, because we grow grain to feed. cut home, and that all these areas of land could be used to either to treat refers it to nature or to feed humans. Just a few thoughts. And we all know about the extensive use of plastic and all the problems that that's causing. I think most of us are aware of that. So do you aim to use as little plastic as possible? I've discovered a shop now where they don't wrap all vegetables up in plastic, so I can try to go there. You might want to think of buying a greener car, green electricity, install solar panels, limit the use of electricity by not putting your telly or other appliances on standby all day. And of course, in the grand scheme of things, it may not make that much difference, and there's lots of people do it, but it has to start somewhere. And I think, yeah, for me, it's a matter of principle, really. Now, and again, you know, I'm not standing here saying, oh, you have to do this. I think the last thing we want, or I want, is that we start policing it, so we ought to be very legalistic about it and say, oh, what have you done last week? What have you done last week? But I think there's a value in being more aware that these kind of lifestyle changes are as much part of our Christian witness as other things we do. Now, there is one practical thing we can do all do today if you want to. It's related to the cards you will have found on your chairs. As it happens, Tearfund is running a campaign about solar energy, and they're planning to send these cards to the World Bank, because the World Bank is apparently planning to provide people in rural areas in Africa and Asia with electricity. These are cards, in case you haven't seen them yet. Such is great, of course, but they intend to encourage the use of fossil fuels like oil. But that implies creating an infrastructure, it may destroy some parts of nature, it will cost lots of money, it will cause more pollution. So Tearfund is therefore calling on the World Bank to skip that stage and instead go to solar energy instead, straight away. By signing these cards, you can support a Stephen campaign. Now, if you do want to sign, I'd like to ask you to do it today so that I can take them home and then I'll send them all off to Stephen later this week. I would like us to watch a short film that shows or gives an example of how solar energy can make a huge difference for people in poor countries. I'm going to try this, Richard, but otherwise, I'm afraid.
It's dry.
I arrived here in 2012. I find the people here suffering so much.
There is no electricity, therefore no light. People had to travel a long way for help, especially at night.
Amongst women, childbirth was a problem, and there was a high mortality rate. Some mothers even used to die in labor too.
Before the clinic existed, when you were giving birth, you had to go to Bunia. It would have been difficult to get to Bunia, because it is hard to get a motorcycle at night. And traveling to Bunia takes 3 hours.
A lack of access to electricity continued to make giving birth incredibly difficult in Ituri province. But in 2013, they managed to buy a solar panel for their health centre.
Before the solar panels, we used torches during transports and when mothers were giving birth. The solar panels are helping so much because now they provide light so we can work at night. We are really helping the women here.
I give birth here in the light.
Having access to electricity means women like Isabel and Destin can give birth safely at night. And it enables people living in poverty to unlock their God-given potential. Children can study in the evenings. Farmers can pump water to grow food for their families. And medication and vaccines can be stored, improving health and people's lives. A central grid powered by fossil fuels is expensive and slow to reach rural communities, And the quickest and cheapest way to improve access to energy for people like Isabel is through energy like solar power, which is local, clean, and renewable. This will bring light to dark places without damaging God's creation and contributing to climate change. The UK government spends money on improving people's access to energy through the World Bank, which aims to end extreme poverty by 2030. But only 3% of the World Bank's energy funding goes on local renewable energy that best helps people in poverty, while billions is spent on polluting fossil fuels. Join us by asking the UK government's representative to call on the World Bank to invest in local, clean and renewable energy, shifting the balance of their funding away from supporting fossil fuels. If we act together, we can see more women giving birth safely in the light, and the God-given potential of people like Isabel and her children being unlocked.
He works for the International Justice Mission. You may have heard of that organisation because Terry Tennant chaired it for quite a while. He was the moderator at Protestant Baptist Church a while ago, and I believe he's still a member there. And just briefly, the International Justice Mission focuses on freeing people who are caught in modern slavery, literally helping them to become free. Now, Abby talked about lament, and he used Psalm 10 as the basis for his talk. He told us that in their office in the UK, they start every day with prayer. And over the years, lament has become an important part of these prayers. They tell God about the difficult situations the people they work for find themselves in. They cry out to God, telling him about the injustices these people face. Lament, I think, is a way of telling God exactly how it is, how you feel, how you experience a certain situation. When you read Psalm 10, the psalmist is doing exactly that. Now let's go through it together, because there's a certain structure to this psalm that you see in other psalms of lament. The writer starts off by asking God, "Why, O Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourselves in time of trouble?" He acknowledges God straight away. He calls him Lord. But then in a way, he takes him to task in no uncertain terms. Where are you? Why are you hiding? I wonder if we often skip that stage in our prayers. We start asking God for his help right away. Thank him in advance for his answer to our prayers. We may have the feeling that God is so great that we ought to be thankful all the time, regardless of our situation. And yes, the Bible calls us to be thankful. But that's not all of it. Abby suggested that perhaps you have forgotten how to lament, to tell him how we feel. Perhaps you haven't even learned it. There are lots of charms of lament in the Bible. And think of the book of Job. Lamentations, part of the Bible. Funny thing was, when I looked for an interesting hymn to sing at the end of the, or a suitable hymn, rather, to sing at the end of the service, I went through the first 500 in our hymn book. And as far as I could see, none of them were actually a hymn of lament. I thought, this is interesting. Loads of psalms of lament. My guess is that maybe even a third, I haven't counted them, have an element of lament in them. That's about 50 out of 150. And none in the first 500 in our hymn book. I didn't bother to check the rest because by then I had found a few that were suitable. And I would say that this psalm, like many others, suggests that there is nothing wrong with lament. The psalmist continues, and if you want to read it with me, verses 2 to 5. In his arrogance, the wicked man hunts down the weak, who are caught in the schemes he devises. He boasts of the cravings of his heart. He blesses the greedy and reviles the Lord. In his pride, the wicked doesn't seek him. In all his thoughts, there is no room for God. His ways are always prosperous. He is haughty, and your laws are far from him. He sneers at all his enemies. He tells God what he sees around him, basically. Now, as it happened, shortly after the Justice Conference, during one of our Time for God sessions, we had a time of prayer. And one of us prayed about the street fires and murders in London. She just told God what was going on and how awful she felt it is. And then she asked him to intervene. And I thought, that's lament. Just like the writer of the psalm, this person told God exactly what was on her heart, what the situation was like and what she felt about it. Of course you could say, well, you don't have to tell God because he already knows. But, of course, he wants to share our hearts with him. And I believe that this is one of the ways to do this, is to lament. And going back to the structure I mentioned, it starts off by acknowledging God. Then the psalmist lays his soul bare before God. And at the end, he acknowledges God as Lord again, stating that he knows that God is able to step in. Now, before we have a further look at the psalm, let's define what lament is and isn't. It's not moaning, complaining, having pity on ourselves. Lament is pouring our hearts out to God and telling him how awful a certain situation is. We evangelicals maybe tend to focus too much on praising and thanking God, but it is perfectly biblical to tell him what is going on in our lives or in the wider world. But what about a New Testament message, you may think? Because all the Bible books I've quoted are from the Old Testament. Well, I'd like to quote Abby George here. He said, "The issue is, how does one who believes in the resurrection deal with injustice? Yes, Jesus' resurrection has provided a solution to all the injustices in the world. But we are in the not yet, in between the resurrection and his second coming. There is no contradiction between belief in the vision of the gospel and lament. It is actually disbelief that creates prophetic outrage about injustice." And the next thing he said, I think, is extremely important. "We are often unwilling to face our pain and suffering, but we are never going to make any progress on the journey of justice if we are not going to stop and kneel by the man who is in pain. We cannot walk by. Lament forces us to focus on suffering, to be present in the midst of suffering. That cannot be done from the safe confines of our homes, our church. Lament calls us to feel the brokenness of the world." And he went on, "One of the reasons we resist lament is that it is the end of our innocence. We don't do slavery, trafficking, homelessness, do we? But the challenge is to keep naming the truth, to keep being disturbed and uncomfortable. We are used to suppress lament." Now, for me personally, that's me, and forgive me for saying this, I sometimes wonder if that is part of the British stiff upper lip culture. We don't moan, we focus on the positive, we carry on. And I've got this little theory that there is an evangelical version of it. We laugh about the problems, we minimize them, and then instead we focus on God's greatness and goodness. And then we think that that's more biblical. But is it? Like a psalmist, we can tell God about situations that hurt or upset us, whether in our own lives or in the wider world. At the moment, I often cry out to God about the situation of my sister Mia and her illness. You may have friends or family members going through similar situations. You may be hurting yourself. Tell him, he wants to know. You may have a specific situation in this country or in the wider world on your heart, and you can cry out to God for them. If God has given you a burden for these people, for that situation, tell him. And it might be hard, as Abby George said, it might be difficult to do. But it might be very necessary, very needed to, because it's a form of intercession, I would suggest. Now, going back to Psalm 10 and the structure in it, we can see that in verses 6 to 9, the psalmist carries on by telling God about the situation he's facing. He doesn't seem to be speaking about himself, but about a situation around him where godless people are living their lives as they wish and suppress others in the process. And he uses pretty strong words. Look at verse 9. He says, he, that's the evil person, lies in wait like a lion in cover. He lies in watch to catch the helpless. He catches the helpless and drags them off in his net. He lies in wait. He lies in watch. Catches. And then the psalm continues, his victims are crushed, they collapse, they fall under his strength. It is too much for the people falling victim to this person. And then the evil person says, God has forgotten. He covers his face and never sees. So he thinks he can just carry on. Now, I wrote a few books at the Justice Conference, and one of these is this one, called God on Mute, written by a man called Pete Gray. Now, Pete is the man who initiated the 24/7 prayer movement and leads it. And in this book, he writes about unanswered prayer. Interestingly, a few people in our Time for God group have been reading some other books of his, and he's really a very good writer. But in this book, he writes about situations where God doesn't seem to hear us, doesn't seem to answer our prayers. Now, he starts off by telling about a situation that he and his wife experienced when their second child was just 7 weeks old. In the middle of the night, his wife started to become really unwell. And in the end, it turned out that she had a massive epileptic seizure. And in the end, she came through unscathed, no lasting brain damage. But she still has epilepsy. And despite their prayers, God hasn't healed her from that illness. And he says in the book, like, we don't always understand why God doesn't answer prayers. I mean, I can't repeat the whole book in 5 minutes, but, you know, there are times that we have to struggle with the darkness, with the unanswered prayers, or the, maybe even the idea, the feeling that God doesn't even listen. So let's carry on to Psalm 10. Look at verse 12. Because there he goes back to God. And he says, arise, Lord, lift up your hand. Don't forget the helpless. So he asks him to intervene, to step in. He expresses his faith, his trust, that God can do this. Look at verse 14. But you, O God, you see trouble and grief. You consider it to take it in hand. The victim commits himself to you. You are the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked and evil man. Call him to account for his wickedness. God considers the grief and pain you go through. Your friends or relatives go through. People in this town go through. People in this world go through. And we can bring it before him and he will take it in hand. Verses 17 and 18, you hear, O God, the desire of the afflicted. You encourage them, and you listen to their cry, defending the fatherless and the oppressed, in order that man, who is of the earth, may terrify no more. The interesting thing, I think, about these verses is that the psalmist doesn't suddenly start praising God. In a way, he's almost taking him to task. He says, Lord, this is how you are. This is how I know you from history. I want you to step in again. I want you to show me that you are still the same. And I think we can do the same when we pray in intercession, when we bring situations before God. It's an important and valid way of doing justice. And it's something all of us can do, regardless of our age, our health, our fitness, our circumstances. We can do it at home, here in the church, when we meet with friends. It's a way of doing justice because you're calling on God to act, to intervene in an unjust situation. You're calling on him in his character of a God who is just. And going back to Michael Curry's comment that you can't change the entire world, perhaps God wants to give you a burden for a specific country or a specific group of people to pray for. Perhaps your focus needs to be on your neighbours, your relatives, your own family. But dare to speak in terms of lament, I would suggest. Lay it before him. And I actually want to take it a step further. and may not apply to every situation, but I think sometimes if we don't lament, especially about our own situations, we can't come to that place where we can see God's greatness. Because if we don't lament about it, we may be quietly angry with God for it, and then we withdraw ourselves from him because he doesn't listen. But like Jacob, we may have to wrestle with God about these issues in our lives, the issues in our families, among our church, among our friends, sorry, in this nation, in this world. And that's a process, sadly, that we have to go through over and over again, because this life is never going to be perfect. Now let's go back to verse 14 of Psalm 10. But you, O God, do see trouble and grief. You consider it to take it in hand. And thinking about us, you know, God knows the nitty-gritty of our daily lives. He knows about David who has to get up at 3 a.m. every morning for work, about Steve and Pauline who are on their feet every day in their jobs, even when their health isn't great. And I'm not saying that that is a cause for lament for them, because I don't know, but it could be. And they can tell God about it. I'm thinking of people like Linda and Marion, who, because of their physical problems, probably take a lot of time in the morning just to get washed and dressed. And it might be difficult and painful for them, and they are allowed to lament about it. But he considers it to take it in hand. And that's, I think, where the difference comes in between the prayer of lament and moaning or self-pity. Because if you put your circumstances in God's hands, he will take it in hand. The situation may not change, as Steve actually said earlier this morning, and yet it does, because the way we feel about it may be different, and then it may become lighter. Now, I hope you will take this as a message of encouragement. I would suggest and encourage you not to skip over your difficulties or to ignore them. Bring them before God, but don't stop there. Express your trust in him too. Like the psalmist, have the courage to take him to task. Have the courage to struggle with him. It will bring you closer to God. And whether you do this about yourself or about the situation around you, in your family or in the wider world, I think this is what God wants us to do. I would like to take a few moments to be quiet. If you feel that there is a situation you want to pray out loud about now, then please do so. In the meantime, maybe I can ask Steve to come up so we can then sing our final hymn when I sort of close the prayer. Lord, creator of this world, you know our hearts. You know the situations we find ourselves in. Difficulties with our jobs or with our health. Concerns about our family. Concerns about where this country is going, where this world is going. We want to express our trust in you. We want to say that we know that in the end, you've got it in hand. Amen.